Good morning, everyone. My name is John Palfrey from the Berkman Center. I just wanted to say a very brief welcome and thank you for coming, and thank you to those who are from afar watching the webcam. This is being recorded and broadcast and so forth, so everything everybody's saying is on the record for perpetuity, as relevant to our identity and privacy conversation today. On behalf of the Berkman Center, want to thank our great friends from Project Zero for coming over today and talking about your work and others who hopefully will join in this conversation. We have a huge interest in the way in which young people are interacting with technologies and with one another, and couldn't be happier to have be in the Cambridge area with Project Zero and New Media Literacies and others here working on this from whom to learn. So thank you guys for coming over. This is meant to be a free-ranging, freewheeling conversation based on some of the best research in the field. We're extremely eager to hear it. Miriam, Simone, thank you for pulling this together and pulling together so much work around here at the Berkman Center. Is there anything else, Miriam, by way of logistics you want to say before we launch in?
Just to say that at 12 we're going to have a little break for lunch, and it's going to be right after.
And then we'll hopefully go until what time do we have?
Till one.
So, and I imagine people are busy, so if we can't stay till one, quite understand, but if we can spend 2 hours together, that would be quite wonderful. So with that, I'd love to turn it over to those who will.
All right. Good morning. As John mentioned, we're from Project Zero at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. My name's Andrea Flores.
I'm John Francis.
We're both RAs on the project. And our approach at the Good Play Project is kind of based in a couple of disciplines, based in education, developmental psychology, sociology. And our leading interest is ethics in the new digital media. And by ethics, we mean to what extent do young people reflect on the responsibilities in their roles that they're taking online? And we've written a white paper, and in that, through informant interviews with educators and academics and engaged youth, we identified 5 major ethical fault lines that young people are struggling with online, 2 of which we'll talk about more in depth today, identity and privacy, but the other 3 are authorship and ownership, plagiarism issues, copyright issues, credibility, and participation. And there's a lot of overlap, and this is kind of a broad overview of our project. But as we move into the data collection part of our project, we're undertaking 120 interviews with young people, 60 participants, roughly 20 in each group, 20 high school, 20 college, 20 post-college. And in the data that we collect from them is a survey about their usage, and the first interview is kind of a narrative of their digital media use, and the second interview we give them hypothetical situations in those ethical fault lines, identity situations, privacy situations, and ask them how they would act. So our kind of approach to identity has been to look at it through kind of this developmental perspective, that the major work of adolescence is forming an identity. And that this is kind of with a social understanding that a lot of that has been moved to an online context, that because of increased pressures on youth time, a lot of this work is happening online. So in our white paper, we kind of discuss these topics through promises or potential benefits and perils, potential harms. And the first two promises are self-expression and reflection, that in online spaces, youth are able to explore interests, aspects of their personality that perhaps in a more in-depth way than they are offline. For example, a shy kid can be more verbal. And as they explore these interests and aspects of themselves, they have to think about the personal meanings to presenting these facets of themselves online. And our kind of guiding question for these two promises is, how can online self-expression and reflection play a positive role in youth identity development? A final promise is feedback, and that this is an important part of kind of the general psychological development of a young person, that as they move away from families and into more peer environments, they increasingly rely on the feedback from people their own age. And that online, through commenting and friending, they're able to get this important feedback in a low-stakes way. The first peril that we see that is facing young people is deception. And while the online setting allows them to pursue, you know, different facets of themselves, this can lead into deception. And our question here is, under what circumstances does identity play lead to deception? And is it a lack of understanding of others' expectations for their self-presentations? And how can we scaffold youth to understand what the different perspectives people have? The second harm is that youth can have harmful or fragmented identities. By harmful identities, we mean kind of experimenting with hateful identities and perpetrating harms online, kind of extreme cyberbullying. And fragmented identities, that as youth kind of move across different formats, are they spreading themselves too thin? And not meaning that there needs to be a set, unitary conception of self, but are they reflecting about what it means to have themselves in these different contexts? The final peril would be this over-reliance on feedback, that it becomes less about personal exploration and reflection and more about performing for others, how to entertain people. So kind of guiding these final two perils are, what are the costs to youth and what do they stand to gain by performing their identities in a vast public, which obviously overlaps with privacy. So from the interviews that we've completed so far, we have three preliminary findings. Yes, youth are exploring multiple identities and interests online, but when we speak to them about it, they don't see these as incompatible with their offline presentations of self, but as merely context appropriate. We spoke with a young woman who was in high school and felt more comfortable exploring the more tech-savvy part of herself online because her friends offline wouldn't understand, and she was afraid they might ridicule her for those interests. Second is that feedback is important, but it seems to be very much tied to the developmental stage of the young people, that many have pointed to positive feedback they've received online and being able to build personal confidence offline or feeling connected to a broader sense of community. One subject we spoke to had joined a Mass Pride teen organization and felt more connected to his local gay and lesbian youth community. But there's also evidence that as they grow up, they're less reliant on this feedback. And subjects mentioned in our older age cohort that, you know, as a younger teenager, they relied on it more, and now it doesn't mean as much. Finally, while deception is a concern, there seems to be a pretty high level of awareness of performances online, and that youth have used words like filtering and reconfiguring to describe the process of presenting oneself online. But interestingly, while they're aware of these performances, they're showing kind of some inconsistency in how they assess people's identities online. And while people may perform identities and they're aware of that, they're still using these performances as a way to tell, is the word they use, what someone is like. And they say that you can pinpoint someone from music preferences, TV show preferences, and photos of them online. So there's a disconnection there between knowing there's a performance and how to judge that performance.
Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the issue of privacy now. It's kind of very broad overviews. But so in considering issues around privacy, we're really thinking about how youth handle their privacy, their own privacy, as well as the private information of other people. So with identity, there are promises and perils to this. Some of the promises include, so online disclosure of personal information can really help youth be empowered to explore aspects of their personality that they might not feel comfortable doing offline. And you know, they do that through communities of support. So they might find communities where they feel safe, kind of exploring these different parts of themselves. And they can work through difficult issues in their lives. And adolescence is often a time that's rife with, difficult issues, such as, you know, maybe you're going through issues with your sexuality, family issues, coping with death. So those are the first two promises. The third promise is a heightened responsibility for others' privacy. And what we mean by that is that we kind of have a hope that there's and interactive communities can provide opportunities for a development of what we call like an ethic of privacy, which helps them, young people, represent themselves in responsible and considerate ways towards other people. So, you know, they're responsible with their own and other people's privacy. On the peril side of things, one peril is a culture of disclosure. As Dana Boyd has written about, young people tend to have a tendency to overshare information online about themselves and not considering the issues of persistence, searchability, and the replicability of their information online. And there are also a lot of young people is thought that aren't really thinking about the audiences for disclosure. So one of the leading questions here is how much personal information is it reasonable for young people to share online? And how should young people consider unintended audiences online? Second privacy is, the second peril is deception. Deception is often used as a method of privacy management online. But the concern that we have is that deception could become normative online to the extent that credibility and trust of others will always kind of be in question in online communities. So it's you never kind of know who you can trust with what. And the final peril is distance. The internet may cause youth to underestimate or overestimate the distance between themselves and others. So for example, a person may over-identify with an individual or a community online to the point where they lose their own sense of identity and where they might become entangled in a relationship that could be dangerous to them. On the flip side of that, anonymity and deception can reduce responsibility that young people feel towards other people. And it reduces or increases their distance from the consequences of bad play online. So some of the leading questions we had going into our research was, what does it mean to manage privacy in an ethical manner online? And what might be the long-term consequences for the individual and society? So as we've done some interviews, we have three preliminary findings so far. The first is that young people do have an awareness of unintended audiences. They're not completely oblivious that there are people out there who they don't know who are looking at their personal information. And privacy is a concern for young people. They're not just completely oblivious to the issue. And they do take steps to manage their privacy. However, I think it's also important to recognize that they still may hold different standards for what is private information than do older generations of people. So, you know, many issues that come up, or one issue that comes up in many interviews that we've had so far is, you know, students who have pictures of on their Facebook profile of, you know, parties, there's drinking, whatever. But, you know, and it's not that they're not thinking about the issues around putting those pictures up, but they just have a different conception of what is private and what is not. The next finding is the presence of empowering disclosures. And what we mean by that is, so by sharing, and this is very much related to the issue of identity, by sharing parts of themselves that they might be considered private, young people can explore different parts of their identity or creative outlets that they might not feel comfortable doing offline. The final finding is risks of disclosure are content dependent. And what I mean by that is it seems so far that a lot of the young people we're talking to are saying that privacy only matters if there are serious consequences to the disclosure. It only matters if the stakes are high. So kind of mundane disclosures like your favorite music, your favorite books, pictures of your friends in kind of non-compromising situations are not really important enough to worry about in terms of privacy. It's just, once again, it's kind of like a shifting of what is private and what is not. So as we're In the third year of our project, we're going to be developing curriculum activities. We've already started that, actually. So in collaboration with Project New Media Literacies at MIT, we started creating activities around the issues of authorship and ownership, and also we just started doing privacy. So just very briefly, I'm going to go through the skills and tools that we're thinking about when we're creating these activities. So the skills we want to impart are the ability of young people to reflect on their actions online, getting them to understand multiple perspectives of other players online, and getting them to think about what is responsible action online. And some of the tools we're using, the forms of curriculum are role plays, dilemmas, writing exercises. And some of the considerations that we're thinking about when we're creating these are the context of their, you know, their online activities, the age. There's definitely going to be differences in the types of curriculum activities that are going to be appropriate for younger people, younger students and older students. One of the teachers we talked to said that authorship and ownership is an issue that's coming up a lot earlier than you might expect, like fourth grade. The cultural norms of the students, and one really big issue is preparing teachers to be able to handle the types of issues that are coming up. Some of the issues are very complex, such as authorship and ownership. A lot of people don't really understand the very complex copyright, plagiarism issues. So preparing teachers or facilitators, whoever's going to be, you know, interacting with young people, to be able to tackle those issues is a challenge and something that we're going to be working on very closely. So that's it. Thank you.
Open it up.
So Judith Dominic is actually
going to do the first response.
Okay. So I could do it. I'm going to just talk and then I have some visuals if it seems to make sense. But I just wanted to respond to a number of the pieces you came up. For those who don't know me, I run a research group at the MIT Media Lab called the Sociable Media Group, and we're primarily a design group. So a lot of what our interest is taking a lot of those sorts of issues and thinking about how new designs can affect it, and also making sure that as designers we're keeping these issues in mind. And so I'm going to give a quick response about sort of some of the technological ways we think about this, and we also try and think about what sort of the future 5-10 years that will hold. And so I'm not going to go into any of these in depth, but I think this will help shape the conversation. One is the first thing you talked about was this issue of multiple identities. And we've used, actually, when Dana Boyd was a graduate student of mine, she did a thesis on faceted identity. And I think it's a useful distinction to make between this idea that identities are fragmented, that you have completely separate multiple identities, but that what we're used to in our everyday life is a world where identity is somewhat faceted, and often those facets aren't necessarily, can be separated from each other. And so this and many other things that we deal with online has to do with the fact that much of how we deal with people online is taking what we're accustomed to in face-to-face experiences and bringing it to a new space where it doesn't quite make the same sense. A lot of what happens with, for instance, social networking sites is these multiple facets get collapsed. There was a big article in the Washington Post earlier this week about school teachers who are 21, 22 years old and have the sort of their typical Facebook profiles, and it's them, at parties, and they got fired because parents of their students were very upset to see, you know, the school teacher out partying. And so one of the things we have to deal with is not just the fragmentation of identity, but the fact, I think more is with a lot of kids growing up today, the complete collapse of the boundaries between these separate spaces. So I think part of the design question is, how can we deal with this whole issue of what is an identity? That we're used to a norm of a single body being one person. And online, how do we start managing it? With something like Google, it's very hard. Even if you keep multiple email addresses and multiple names, it just takes really one time where a couple of those are put together and it's clear that these are all a single identity. So understanding how to keep some of the separation in identities may be the big challenge. You talked about, also with social networking, how people use pinpointing through media and music, etc. And I think one of the interesting issues there, and then you ended by saying, well, you know, if you mention your musical taste, etc., maybe that's such a minor thing, it's not a privacy concern. But I think we want to also open up our questions about really what is privacy, which is a whole, you know, that could be a multiple year study, just what is this notion of the context of privacy. But one sort of quick way of thinking about it is that when you have something that was meant for one context, and you said this and you intended it for a particular context, and it gets moved and viewed by a unintended audience, is when you have a privacy violation. And for one thing, the both the exposure of our personal into public sites like networking sites and any kind of online profile makes this very common, and certainly the persistence of things that we've been used to having as ephemeral makes this a big issue, is that you may say something for 20 people, you might not care if it's public, but you might care in 20 years when it turns out that still persists. So I think one of the huge issues that especially young people will be dealing with now is that we live in a world where we're used to a lot of our past disappearing into the mists of time, and all those mists are starting to disappear for them. And so how they'll handle it may be that it will just seem absolutely primitive to meet people and not be able to trace the last 30 years of their history. And they might just think, oh my God, how did people ever live like that? But it will certainly be a change. But more to the point today, I think it's also useful to think about how much the susceptibility that people have to marketing is also a big privacy issue. And when you start thinking about the media and your taste and tastes in music, et cetera, there's a interesting balance simply about what is taste. How much of this is sort of coming from the ground up, and how much is a sort of co-evolution of increasingly sophisticated marketers kind of shaping your tastes, shaping your values, using the information that's available in these public spaces to change how people think, what their goals are, what they're interested in. You know, and especially as more and more of our day-to-day interactions with people happen through some kind of medium that we're used to thinking of as free, and it's free because it's advertiser supported, and so it's, you know, it sort of feels like this great scam that, wow, we can get all this stuff for free, and you know, there's just some ads here. But you might also think, well, maybe those advertisers are not actually that dumb, that they really do realize that they are influencing things, making people much more intent on purchasing and buying, on traveling, and just endless consumption. And that might be one of the big privacy issues, is that as they know, you know, more and more of your taste, your friends' taste, they can market to you better. And there's also the whole issue of to what extent, you know, it's interesting, you do a Google search on monetized social network, the amount of fascination there is with this, like, holy grail, I haven't quite figured out how to do it yet, but there's a sense that there's going to be a way to turn all of your connections into little nodes in which you are a mini marketer to all of your friends.
And if so, there's not, a lot of VCs will have some red ink on their balance sheets.
Right, exactly. So, you know, so I think the privacy issues are not just some of the big ones that we're concerned about things being viewed by someone who is adverse to you, which is certainly a big issue, but I think also just the whole notion of what, how you, of people who are insidiously shaping how you think is a privacy issue. And then finally, the issue about credibility and trust, also a, you know, a multi-year question, but I think here a lot of the issues to understand are how much of our notions of what, of, for instance, how we trust someone and what we think of someone's identity are really formed in real life. And I won't bother to go and hook it up now, but I have these slides from Second Life. And one of the things about Second Life is people often say, well, using a site like this or being able to see pictures of someone, even if it's an avatar, just makes me feel like I have a better sense of trust. You know, I can look there's other people there, it's real. But, you know, a lot of our sense of trust comes from things like what's called the baby face overgeneralization problem. Is if someone has like big eyes and a turned up nose and a little pointy chin, they're really, really innocent looking. And so you can make an avatar that's really very trustworthy looking, And it will certainly use a lot of things that, you know, perhaps we have sort of faulty trust mechanisms in real life. And then you can just, with a few clicks, you can give it a bigger forehead and a squarer chin, and all of a sudden it's not trustworthy at all. So a lot of the signals and cues we use to ascertain trustworthiness, which may be faulty in real life, become extremely cheap signals online, but they're still viscerally very, very powerful. And so here, from certainly from a design perspective, I think ideally as people grow up with more and more media, a greater understanding of what the value of different media are, is that things that are highly manipulable and visual can be very entertaining, and they're really, really good for entertaining. They're in general, they're terrible media when you really do need to ascertain trust. It turns out, for instance, that people are actually best at detecting deception on the telephone, because we're so easily misled by faces that we're actually better at it by phone, though that's on the detection side. On the actual production side, people are the most trustworthy by email, which is a medium that people don't tend to find very trustworthy, because you think, oh, people can manipulate better when they can sit and edit, etc. But it turns out that people's sense of the persistence of email is so strong, they tend to be much more careful about what they say. So part of this notion of what education should be in an era of new media is about really a much more sophisticated understanding of what are the appropriate uses of different media and technology. So that's my response.
Did you want to show us some images?
Maybe as the conversation goes, okay. If it makes sense, but I think it'd be nice to just open it up.
That's
and then
wonderful. So I'm sure there are many reactions. I have no doubt that Wendy Seltzer, among others.
I have one.
Please jump in.
I'm a sociologist, Judy Perol, from Northeastern. And one of the things that strikes me about both your study and the way most people do approach the issue of identity is that it's an entirely individual thing. And of course, in the sociological theory and literature, it's partly socially constructed. And one of the things that strikes me in the privacy problem is that many young people, in our experience anyway, are expecting to have what the theorist Goffman called a backstage area, where they disclose fully to one another, but they're somehow protected by either some permissions they have set or from the same protections called civic inattention, where you go to a pizza parlor and the people at the next table are talking, but you pretend at least to ignore them. And so the idea of the social dimensions of group privacy are very important, and also group identity. I have a student now studying hate sites online, and they actively try to recruit young people into their movements. And there are some sites that one student studied on basically anorexia nervosa that make a positive thing out of it. So it's very, very important, I think, that we also look at the collective identity, and I really like to hear comments about the capitalization, the commodification of just about everything, because there are groups and organizations and economic structures trying very hard to shape identities, both group and individual, and we need to really pay attention to that, as well as to the individual person's maturation process.
Do you guys want to respond from the research perspective?
In our protocol, when we get the kind of narrative of their digital media experience, we do ask them, so who's had the biggest effect on you? And a big percentage of them say, my peers. And one group of a subject we spoke to mentioned that in one particular group at school, it was popular to list rap music as, you know, the thing to listen to, but knowing that none of them actually listened to rap music. But the interesting point, I think, about the consumptive identities online, I've been working on a project on online memorials and the young people on MySpace. And a lot of their memories of the deceased are tied to shared media experiences. So remember when we went to this concert? Whenever I hear this song on the radio, I think of you. And so while their taste may be being shaped by performances or by marketing, they're also repurposing it for their own kind of use. And so while they talk about this is my favorite song and maybe they're getting pop-ups about, you know, related stuff, it becomes the way they talk about it as that's Allison's song. And so there's kind of a refashioning of those identities as well.
Did you guys think about it as personal identity and social identity kind of broken apart, or what's your thinking about that? obviously a fair amount of debate in literature as to whether or not you do that.
Sure. I think we tried to think of them together as obviously you don't create an identity in a vacuum, and the question of feedback is this kind of back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, I think we ask questions. The questions we ask about identity aim to get at both someone's conception of their identity as an individual and the extent to which others are influencing that. But I mean, the other element that's interesting and important to consider is the degree to which individuals have to worry not just about themselves and how they're representing their identities, but how their friends are participating in that, because there's so much interplay on a given social networking profile, such that, you know, a peer group is helping to construct someone's identity by the kinds of comments they post on their page. So in large part, and this is, I think, is a big distinction between offline and online, you relinquish that control over who you are to others as they can participate in, you know, commenting on your MySpace page or your Facebook page, and then in so doing, give clues to other people, the audience of that page, about who you are. And that's not, I don't think it's quite the same as what happens offline. And this is something that Andrea has seen in her analysis of MySpace profiles that have been converted into memorials, is that people, the mourners who are participating in those spaces are constructing this identity of the deceased, who can no longer have a hand in it because they're not here to participate anymore. It's more of a dialogue for people who are living, obviously.
Did you guys look at all in terms of sort of, there's sort of this tension between, you know, there's music and books and all these things that cause people to present themselves, etc., and judge each other on. But at the same time, sort of the internet also allows you to, like, find other people with your, you know, weird, dorky, niche taste that you would never want anyone to know about, but you can find other people that share that enthusiasm, and how people can manage that multiple identity without it being collapsed necessarily. Did people talk about?
Yeah, I mean, there's many, many subjects you talk about. Like, I can think of one in particular who, actually, a lot of gamers seem to talk about, you know, the idea that, you know, most of my friends or peers don't really know I'm into playing World of Warcraft. So, you know, I don't talk about that offline, and I have my own, you know, my own character, my own avatar, but it's not something that is necessarily part of their other online personas. You know, if they have a Facebook, it might not be part of that. So they kind of form communities within a different area.
Yeah. I actually just interviewed someone yesterday, a young woman who has a Facebook that has hundreds of friends on, and then she has a couple of LJ profiles, LiveJournal. One is that totally private to only 6 friends, where she shares her innermost thoughts. And then she has another LJ that's a little bit more open, and it's just for the purpose of connecting with people who have a shared interest around certain bands. And that's something, that LJ profile is not something that her larger group of friends on Facebook necessarily know about. So back to Judith's point about different facets of people's identities, they're reflected in these very distinct profiles that some of them are setting up and kind of enacting those aspects of themselves separately from one another.
Did you ask her how she actually pulled that group together of the bands? Like, I'm curious if it, in relation to the real world and the virtual, did she find those people online away from her Facebook, or is it friends within her high school that have been pulled on there?
She found them online. Certainly has friends who are interested in the same music she's you know, into offline, but she found friends on LJ who were very dedicated to these different music subcultures.
So that's an interesting example for these, you know, different contexts, and do we think that the technology is doing the right thing and setting up the right boundaries between those contexts, or should it be stronger? Would these people be threatened if someone were to take two contexts and combine them, as with relatively little effort somebody could probably do.
You know, we built some, started with a Moo and built some work group software, but it turned out that the students did some projects on developing public and private spaces, and it comes back to your notion of context and the Second Life now. Mm-hmm. It, that we had things that were called public parks and were called public libraries and were called people's apartments, and the behaviors very much fell in with the expectations of that kind of room. And it turned out that eventually people abandoned it and said it wasn't fun to do that anymore and went to places like Facebook. But there was this sense that you got context from having a virtual space that somehow mimicked the expectations of real spaces. And perhaps we simply haven't had the norms emerge for these new kind of places, and we're all getting very upset about something that's being worked out by people as they negotiate these every day.
It's very similar. I was curious how you think about it. 20 plus years ago, I was doing research on kids play and kids play around computers, because it wasn't through computers at that point. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's totally different. Things have changed so dramatically, and they're not done changing. And so the idea that there's things evolve so quickly, I do wonder if there are, one, that kids at a time when they are uncovering their identity, and you're seeing potentially a different experience for those kids versus kids as even a little bit older. And I watch my teenage son, and I am not, I can't go and into Facebook where I have been friended by my teenage son. So I don't talk to him through Facebook, but I've been friended by him, and I think that's, I just give myself credit for that every day. But I can't communicate through Facebook the way he does, because my boss is there with me. Some of his friends are there. My students, graduate students are there. And I can't say one thing that feels right for all those groups. But I can go into LinkedIn and talk and do, you know, I'm looking for to hire somebody in these other kinds of more communities. And I just wonder if there's a, how do you think about both the trajectory of of the evolution of the vehicles and the technology and the developmental stages of the audience?
That right there lists a lot of the points that Jude was talking about in terms of the need for design. I mean, thinking about managing identities into these direct interfaces. So certainly people will repurpose these tools over time to suit the kind of social conditions the designs afford. But it's also a need for role in design in directly thinking about these identities to be able to go and partition out where you feel necessary, or to be able to understand the purpose of particular kinds of communities. It's a bit dangerous right now, I think, with things like Open Social and Open ID, the notion that you have a single identity that links everything together, or even Google's trying to then link, I forget the name of the project, but multiple kinds of identities by noticing links and pulling them together, and treating this as one single unit, because it's certainly the case, as the research confirmed, or as Judith had mentioned, we have all these different facets and masks that we wear in regular life. I think one thing that we'll see as a trend, maybe not necessarily from the people designing the technology currently, because they want to simplify things in the designer or be able to further monetize by having the single identity that you can pull all the data together with. But already you're starting to see with Facebook, for example, they're allowing grouping, where you can select different kinds of friends that you share specific types of photos with. And only as a matter of time, my hope at least, is that we're going to start to find more designs that allow further partitioning and further types of masks that we wear to be able to manage these complex issues. Because we certainly do this in real life. We're very, very good at managing extremely complicated social identities and different aspects of our lives with people. And especially being able to do things like deception and manipulation and lying, right? And as more and more of the technology permits these kinds of things and fuzzy boundaries, I think the situation will necessarily get better.
When we they're very aware, especially as we talk to graduating seniors in college, I need to clean up my Facebook profile, or I know the potential employers might be looking at this. But we also see that they are making use of the technological functions that are available to them at this point, that students talk about, well, I make some of my LiveJournal entries private, some of them public, and it depends on who I want to see them. And one subject that I spoke to had a MySpace profile and a Facebook profile, so across two sites. And he used his MySpace, he called it the rap side of him. He's a local rapper, and that's where he puts that, and there's no personal information on there, and he uses that as a way to book shows. Mm-hmm. He called his Facebook profile the real me, where he has his interests, links to his friends, pictures with his friends. But he said, interestingly, he kind of put it together in the interview, but I link to my MySpace page on my Facebook page, so someone can find me. But he said, but that's part of me. So it's important for other people to know that I'm also a rapper, but it's just one part that I include on my page. So I think they're kind of aware that there's overlap, and they're also aware that they can, in some ways, in the limits of the current technology, they can limit it, but maybe not as much as they would like. But they're kind of making it as they go along, too.
Right. And the technology's changing. Yeah. It's a moving target.
Yeah.
So I wonder, from a design point of view, what possibilities there might be to think about situations where it's not just the rebound on oneself that is the kind of privacy crisis, especially, let's say, issues where there might be intergenerational conflicts, people with different kind of ethics and different social identities. For instance, let's say adopted children searching for birth parents, where there are often extremely intense identity issues important to adolescence, where revelation and, you know, exposure is the desired outcome, and there's often a kind of intense involvement in the exploration of the self that might not, by definition, respect the privacy needs or considerations of birth parents or adoptive parents, for instance. And I wonder, I mean, most of the things like Facebook or MySpace, you give consent for others to come into your space, but not necessarily the other way around.
I think even in less extreme circumstances, you know, Aaron was mentioning that you want to be able to show different things to different people, but I think one of the things that very few, if any, sites right now do is let you set different privacy settings on other people. So, you know, right now, like, you know, even for a teenager might think, you know, maybe these are my friends, but my parents can see some of my friends, but they can't see all of my friends, because one of the things that's hard is you can't control everyone else's behavior. And so once you link to them, it's not just the music you link to, but it's all the tastes of all of your own friends. So I think pieces of that can be very interesting also, because part of it right now that makes these sites very lightweight still is that the cost to linking is so low, and what it expresses is very little. And so, you know, the more privacy settings there are, it not only enhances privacy, but it can also enhance what the meaning of these links are. You know, Orkut for a while tried to have ways that people could, you know, say different things about levels of friendship, which is very socially unacceptable. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you can set the idea that you are not reachable through my site because your site is full of naked pictures of yourself, it changes the cost for being able to evaluate those friendships in a way that starts to make a little bit more sense. Some of it is there's no technological solutions for every privacy issue, and in particular, I mean, you're talking about one version, but all of these deal with a tension between the desire for privacy and the desire for publicity. And both, on the one hand, you know, there's interesting studies even from work on city planning, that what a lot of people really like is to have a seat somewhere where they can watch other people while they're not seen. You know, so you know, there's a whole set of things this goes through beyond the net. But there's also, I think, with a lot of people, that a lot of the currency of the net is attention. You know, if you go and put a profile up, you put this stuff up, and no one pays attention to it, doesn't really make sense. And increasingly, that is the currency of an information space, is the information I put out actually being read by people. And so you touched a little on this notion of performance, and part of that performance is what do you need to do to get some amount of attention. And so these are pieces that the technology can have some help with, but a lot of these are going to be have to be socially negotiated issues about how much can you reveal, who else are you harming when you do that.
I mean, in some cases, the harms of exposure are quite intense. adoption would be one scenario, but I was also thinking about the Duke lacrosse players rape charges from a couple of years ago, where, you know, there are all these rape shield laws that say the names of the accusers and the accused while the case is being litigated are not to be exposed, but it didn't take a genius to Google in and get all the names quite instantly. So there's, I think there are, in fact, perhaps norms on the web that are not only embarrassing, you know, sort of socially, but maybe, you know, have legal consequences to exposure. And it might not be that they're simply evolving, like as yet unformed norms on online, but actively in place norms that are opposed to those that we have in other registers. I mean, sometimes technological fixes are better than normative social norming.
I think about, I'm generally agreeing, and I think about, you know, exposing oneself in in this manner. It's persistent, and we were speaking before about, I think the term was monetizing the network, essentially gathering data that one has put up in various places and forming a marketing profile of an individual, which reminds me of a statistical technique called data mining, which is, in my view, both a blessing and a curse. A question that I would pop out here in terms of privacy is, to what extent do we know and can we guarantee in these technologies that governmental entities, just for instance, can't be in there poking around and form a profile of any individual and watch the emergence of a new civil rights leader or a potential radical or a dangerous person who I would consider dangerous or a person I would consider very meritorious and act on that. I'm not aware of significant research on that or protection against that.
It's a small anecdote, but just a couple days ago I had an interview with someone who was called to court in some strange circumstances and was charged with harassment by this guy. And getting to court, he noticed that a detective, as a piece of evidence, had put up a picture from his MySpace profile of him and his friends in ski masks with paintball guns as a sign of him being a threatening person. And it ended up not being a big deal for him, but it just shows that, like, law enforcement is looking at these things, and no doubt other government entities are making use of all this information that's online.
So. For the youth we've just talked to at the end, we asked them kind of for broader perspectives.
And a lot of the subjects you mentioned, I'm afraid of my identity being stolen online, I'm afraid of people following my moves online as well.
Sam's story is a good example, though, of how difficult it is for someone to, especially if we look, you know, we're interviewing 15 to 25, and developmentally, their 15-year-olds are very different from 25-year-olds, but anyone does not possess the capacity to predict whether, like, something that seems low stakes, like preference, you know, musical taste or a photo like that that was clearly joking, will someday come back to harm
that. Yeah. I mean, if you just think about some of the I was just thinking in terms of, like, your intellectual development during that time, and some of the ideas that I might have held when I was 15 that make me absolutely cringe. And that there might be, you know, the idea that maybe at that point I would have a blog that would have, you know, references to these ideas and bad poetry and so forth that exists to this. I mean, but I mean, also just in terms of credibility in the ability to explore some sort of funky non-mainstream ideas and things like that it's, and not realizing that it's public, but maybe being at that time very proud of those ideas and so forth. I don't know.
I have a legal question about this. Given how mutable information of all types is when it's in digital format, wouldn't one have deniability and say, that's not actually a picture of me, somebody must have Photoshop me in, or I never said this, that wasn't my blog entry. I mean, in some ways you could argue that digital information would be less incriminating than anything before. You could successfully argue deniability.
Like, it presents a defense on evidentiary grounds, right?
Uh-huh.
You can introduce this, but the point is, very often we're talking about the court of public opinion,
We're living in a world where people whose names are spelled similarly to those on some list can't fly on airplanes, so I wouldn't put a lot of hope into this being a deterrent to law enforcement.
I really would love to know who's around the table, so I'll introduce myself when I speak, just because I'd love to also know who you are. But I'm Ilona Holland, and I'm an evaluator. I teach at the Harvard Graduate School of Education in the Technology Innovation and Education Program, but I do program evaluations. But what intrigues me in our conversation, too, is the learning that takes place from the process of engagement. And where I'm going with that is empowerment. Teens in particular often need a sense of empowerment. They don't feel empowered. So even Amazon, the fact that I can rate a book and that rating might indeed influence purchases is very empowering. So that can then, of course, go in both directions. I can be very positive, or I can be very, very damaging to friends. And I mean, we've seen terrible stories of things that can happen. But you're learning from the engagement itself, as opposed to, and I do think that the point made was really important one, that we don't have norms yet. This is all evolving. But it concerns me of how that's going to go and how, and back to you talking about those adults who are older adults, possibly, or maybe not, maybe they're younger adults, but how should we label those? You call them teachers, but they don't necessarily have to be teachers. We're looking for the label of that influencer who would be able to impart some sort of cultural acceptable behaviors and ways of thinking about all this that can help guide the empowerment, because that's a very strong draw, that empowerment piece, I think. And you learn it just from being a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to add that really quick.
Your name, please, your name.
I'm Erin Riley, I'm the research director for Project New Media Literacies. And I'm totally in agreement with you about the opportunities of empowerment here in this study. Plus, we, in a online community for girls that I ran, when we finally, every year, would try bringing them together in a real-world setting, and we studied class because there was a wide range of socioeconomic differences in the girls participating in this community. And when asked about their friends here in the Zoe's Room community versus at home, it was really interesting hearing, like, well, you're a level one, and you'd be a level two at my school. And then to push them to have a conversation in person about, okay, I might not hang out with you at school, but I hang out with you all the time online, brought it back to their school where they started looking at the people in their own community that they weren't really hanging out with in a new light, you know, and I think long term that helps them by being able to try out different economic classes and different identities online. It helps them long term really have a more wider view of people. So that's just one example.
Call this a only pause. For girls, not for boys.
Yeah.
Just to call a pause here for a moment, so that we can all have some lunch. But when we come back, if I might make two suggestions. One is maybe we should just go around while we have sandwiches and say hello to one another and introduce ourselves, which we probably should have done at the start, but we can always remedy it while having sandwiches. And secondly, I'd love to reintroduce to the conversation as a starting topic some of the things we've learned from Henry, in particular about not treating all young people in the same bucket, that plainly one of the things that's important to do is to parse out those on various sides of the participation gap, and maybe to dig a little bit further into what you guys have seen and what some of the others around the table have seen about where and how that participation gap is cutting in this conversation. So maybe if we can take a quick break, and anybody who's watching, we're going to have some sandwiches to share with yourself. We'll reconvene in a minute. And
my blog, as part of my skepticism about the language of digital natives, has been this question of whether we want to lump all young people together and assume they have the same level of access to technology, the same level of comfort and familiarity with these processes that we're talking about. It's pretty clear that there is a generation, you know, in this generation, there's some who've had unlimited access. 24/7 broadband,
mobile access, and others for whom 10 minutes a day on the school computer is about what they get. No capacity to upload or download, mandatory filtering, potential restrictions on social networks and blogging technologies, and a reality that many of the schools they're using don't have access to YouTube at all. So some pretty significant differences in terms of their access to this material. And throughout the MacArthur work, I think people are finding signs that those differences in experience translate into different frames of reference, different habits of mind, different ways of dealing with the online world. I'm curious, you posed the question I would have asked, what, if any, signs are we seeing in the interviews that Goodplay is doing of how those differences might be affecting how these young people are thinking about privacy and identity? Because these gaps affect every aspect of the social skills and cultural competencies that we think young people have been acquiring through the informal channels of their participation online.
One thing I'll say is that our answer might not be that satisfying because we purposefully have recruited young people who are very engaged, mm-hmm. so that their access is going to be, you know, to some extent on the, you know, different from many of their peers. But even within our sample, mm-hmm. we may be seeing some differences.
Well, and also our sample is drawn from, for the high school sample is drawn from three different high schools in the greater Boston area that kind of fall under different free lunch we used as kind of the way to gauge the economic status of the students. So we have one low-income school, one middle-income school, and one high-income school. And, I mean, we haven't really analyzed that data yet to see, you know, are there differences in between each group? I mean, they are all engaged, so there's some sort of you know, baseline level. And from the college students, it's a more mixed bag. You know, it's pretty major schools in the area, and ability to provide financial aid, we have no idea how if the people we're interviewing are getting that or not. But for a couple of the college interviews we talked to, they say that they started downloading when they got to college because that's when they had high-speed internet, and that at home they did not. So there's a little bit of evidence that maybe, you know, access levels change over time, and that does affect their use.
And on the survey we did at the lower income school, I'll say that the staff, the administration was really surprised at the findings that something like 98% of the kids had internet access at home. Now, you know, some of them may be sharing a computer with, you know, several other siblings and really only getting, you know, a limited amount of time online. It's going to be very different from a kid who has their own laptop. So, you know, it's not comparable, but still they were surprised to see how much access their students had.
Can I just say a little bit of something to that? From the focus groups that we've been doing here, as far as privacy goes, I think what came out from us, so when we looked at privacy, we looked at a number of different stakeholders. So privacy in terms of what your friends are seeing online, privacy in terms of strangers on the internet, privacy in terms of the kind of big media blitz around employers and college counselors looking at things, as well as service providers, marketers, and those entities. And what we found was there's kind of two different ways that norms seem to be coping up around privacy. So one is you do what your friends do. So if your friends are, you know, going to the beach, taking rocket over or beach pictures and putting them online, then this is something that you'll do too and find more normal. Whereas somebody that might be in your school in the same economic and kind of technological grouping as you wouldn't do that just because different friend group and kind of different norms arising from that. Where it seems that there is kind of a socioeconomic factor coming into play was around kind of college counselors, college admissions, employers. So the kids at more elite schools, their parents were telling them, be careful what you put online. And this had really nothing to do with kind of marketers or even strangers. It was more all about reputation. You need to guard your reputation. You need to get into college. And so that would kind of spread out around the school. Whereas with some of the kind of lower income students, especially students that come from immigrant backgrounds where their parents just have no idea, and not that they're completely out of it. They tell them, you know, don't talk to strangers online, just because I think it's something that translates easily. This idea of like reputation and colleges looking at profiles, kind of that conversation wouldn't come up at all. And I think it does kind of trickle down. So we started, I think there was kind of a lot of media attention on these issues last winter, and we started our focus groups in October and then went through February. And it seemed that it started kind of with the higher income schools, but that knowledge did start to trickle down for other students as well. So, I mean, I do think that there is issues there, but it also seems to me that the media, I mean, kids are very wary of predators, kids are pretty wary of stalkers, kids are quite concerned about identity theft, and about colleges and about employers, service providers, marketers, government, totally not on the radar. So, that's another point we'll put up.
Yeah, what would you anticipate, or how would you even sort of frame the set of questions that you'd want to ask around identity and privacy in particular?
No, it's. I mean, what we've seen in other areas is that kids who have extended access have a much greater familiarity with the social mechanisms at play on online communities. For example, with the kids who had access at home had a pretty familiarity with Wikipedia, what its credibility was, how to measure how entries there were produced. Those kids who had limited access in school were prone to go in, get the information they needed, pop it on the paper, and take it away without much awareness of the process by which that information was produced. So by extension, we can speculate that the issue of privacy could be experienced in much the same way, that those who had limited access, although they were had fewer mechanisms for disclosure. When I've talked to schools about the prohibiting of YouTube, they say it's as much out of concern for liability of what students might post as it is for any concern of things coming into the school. So there's less opportunities in those contexts to disclose because you have less time to be creating your own sites. You may not have access to the tools create your own sites, you may not have access to tools to manage your own identity in that way, but they may not also understand the dangers or risk or consequences of disclosure or the social mechanisms by which disclosure gets managed within other communities with more extensive participation. And that would be something I think we'd want to look at as you looked at that participation gap.
You know, I think you also, as you talk, it seems to me we also need to look at the research on cell phone use, because it's kind of boring compared to Second Life, but it especially among the poor and in Africa, for example, that cell phones are what's happening. It's how people share photos. It's how they talk to each other constantly, and new cell phone technologies are moving toward easier possibility for group communications. And so I think a lot of what's going on online is also going on cell phones, but technologically mediated in some different ways, and it would be good to look at the cell phone research too.
Well, you know, to add on that, I think it's actually beyond just cell phones, but all media, like a transmedia experience. And you can just look at, for example, the girls who beat up that other girl, and it was all about performance. They wanted to put it on YouTube so that everything's good. And it wasn't just the girls putting it on YouTube, but then the media proliferated it by actually then showing it on the news. I mean, it was on Boston News like 10 times, and they specifically said they wanted to get it on YouTube. So what is people going to do? They're going to go back to YouTube and then add and get what those girls wanted in the end, which was to put it on YouTube, you know? So there's a kind of circular effect here of looking at privacy and when you have this transmedia experience is happening.
Well, someone was mentioning earlier about this idea of the history that's going to follow us around and how normalized that may be, and that you know, people may wonder, you know, how they ever were able to deal without being able to look 15 years in people's pasts, and that may become, I think, a class differentiator for people who were later to the scene, didn't have internet access maybe till they got to college or never really did, and that will sort of always be, you know, no matter what they do, that lack of history will follow people around, and I think that's something that people should think about.
Mm-hmm.
finally have a leg up. Yeah, it may help people, but in some ways.
Stealing the records, online records of everyone until after they're 18, all their childhood records are sealed.
But there's this interesting, you don't even have to be online to be concerned about privacy issues online. Yep. I mean, it just how people perceive the nature of their own image is interesting. So a lot of teachers actually now are starting to worry about kids with cell phone video cameras recording things in the classroom that out of context look ridiculous and then putting those things on the internet.
The absence of that past may be a liability also.
Let's see, Margaret, how do you think the absence of it will be a liability?
In the sense of, you know, in the same way that, for instance, people like to hire people that are like them and that they feel that they can relate to, somebody that they, you know, doesn't have this Facebook profile going back 10 years. People are putting Facebook stuff up, and a lot of it really isn't ultimately that objectionable. And this idea that, you know, 15 years down the road, when people are thinking about hiring people in the same way that you might worry about what people are putting on their Facebook, the idea that somebody doesn't have a Facebook profile versus somebody that does, and you can see that over time they've had interests that are like yours and like people at the company that fit in culturally, et cetera, and so forth.
Is that any different than ordinary class or socioeconomic?
No, it's just another aspect. It's not particularly different, but it's very sort of tangible, and I think a lot of class signifiers, you know, people can slowly develop over time, you know, but this absence of that history is certainly a signal that people can't get away from.
Yeah, that I was just going to ask whether it was that it's harder to fake something appearing 10 years ago in your record than it is to fake something today. So that serves as a more reliable signal, even if it's mixed.
At the time, it was easier to fake. I mean, my cat had an online social networking space for quite a long time before I finally gave it up.
Well, it becomes another element of social capital, which is what I think you're trying to say. You're not on Facebook, and you're at a certain group, so it's represented just, there in a certain way. Then
you already see this in sort of the Facebook-MySpace divide a little bit.
Yeah, there's been quotes where teens have said, if you're not on MySpace, you don't exist, you know, so...
I think of it more pragmatically. I mean, if you had no exposure to the online world and you were a college freshman or starting in a new job and everyone around you had these skills and were talking in this language, you would be that much more disadvantaged and have a hard time catching up.
But just for some perspective, I mean, people do come from really different backgrounds. Like, you can go to college where everyone else in your college has been dating since they were 10 and you've been in a convent school, you know. It may be hard, but it's happened. So I think, yes, yeah, I think it's worthwhile, you know, remembering that a lot of these are distinctions that have happened. It can be hard to lose an accent over time. You know, you can go to a college where everyone's been skiing since they were three, and you never, you know, you've never seen a ski. You know, there's a lot of class distinctions that move around like this. But I think another thing we might also want to keep in mind is that with social network, you know, we're talking now as if, okay, here's this thing, we all need to get used to it, and as if the technology is standing still. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these are technologies that 5 years ago did not even exist. And so I think a lot of the other important thing is to keep an eye out for what are the emerging technologies, because the kids now who are 2 and 3 and just like working on toilet training are going to get into a very, very different world, you know, and then these are, you know, I think some of the things to look at is ubiquitous GPS tracking, maybe a piece of it, a lot, you know, the other things that you need IDs for that you don't need now. So I think there may be just a lot more tracking in our daily life than they're used to. There's, I think the ubiquity of video. I mean, there's between surveillance cameras and people's cameras is going to be very, very high, but also the amount of information that can be derived from video is probably going to change considerably. Right now, computers can't deal with pictures very well, but that's probably not going to be true at some point in the future. So I think the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, Facebook as it exists now will not exist, in a little while, but something completely different. You know, if you walked into a room 6 years ago and said, lots and lots of people are going to just list all of their friends online. And not only they could do that over and over and over, because what the cool place to do this in changes, they could list all their friends and all their interests, they could move it around, and then they're going to sign up for something where every 5 minutes they say something completely mundane about what they're doing. It must be ridiculous, absurd. You know, but it's, you know, it's now accepted. So I think we just need to keep in mind that these things change very, very rapidly.
Yeah. But, you know, back to Twitter and the stupid, I mean, mundane things that people are saying every 5 minutes. If you look at it, it's got a really interesting design feature that it essentially implements a multi-user version of the person-to-person cell phone. And it's like putting your text messaging cell phone stuff up for everybody to see in all of its mundane glory.
I think it, just a little bit in thinking about this in design, it came across to me as how very, very important is design, especially for younger kids in terms of shaping their social norms. So for high schoolers now, the top 4, 8, 12 thing on MySpace like is your life. I mean, it's dictating your relationships, it's dictating your friendships, it's all the fights you're having. Like, I was just talking about, I'm interested to know, I'm sure it was done on purpose, and I'm sure there was very strong design thinking, but I'm interested to think like whether the designer really knew of how much of a central facet of teenage life that would become. Or Facebook, and obviously have done it on purpose in terms of that it's a lot easier to make a public comment, just in terms of the number of clicks and so that you need to go through, than to make a private one. And just how much, and a lot of younger kids that we talk to that don't really realize that just because there's a box with a space on it, you don't need to fill it out. So and just how important design is in starting to really affect these norms as so much socializing happens there.
And some of the things that I didn't hear come up in the discussion of perils, but maybe they're also promises, is this notion of divided attention. And how is it, I mean, there's so much input now that we didn't used to have around who's gathering where, for what purposes, who's thinking, the Twitter, hold on, Twitter thing, you know, what am I thinking right now? What are all of my friends thinking right now? That I don't know how kids learn how to focus on anything and how to actually, you know, take a task through to completion without being diverted. And like I said, that might be a peril, it might be a promise, but to what extent are you looking at those kinds of things and the various research strands that people are engaged in around the room? I mean, I'm concerned about that in a school context, but in a social context, it seems to me to be equally problematic.
Well, multitasking is one of the new media literacy skills, and it's a skill that needs to be acquired. And I think that kids are much more adaptable to us because they're used to being able to silently move from one thing to the next. What we need to help them understand is to be able to know when to switch, you know, from one thing to the next. And by participating in these social networks and what they're doing just in today's everyday life, through practice and application and getting teachers to understand, it can be incorporated into an integral curriculum.
If you look at commercial advertising, for example, the goal there is to distract people from whatever they were doing, focus them on some object, and engage them in impulse behavior. So I think there's a whole economy that's trying to undermine any productive kinds of multitasking. And in some ways, I think multitasking is just a little code word for it's okay to let advertisers work their will on our children.
But I've also, I mean, this is not research I'm familiar with, this is why I asked the question, but I've come to understand that the very notion of multitasking is contested space, and that's why I use the phrase divided attention, because it's that we may actually be processing mainly serially across lots of different slices as opposed to focusing on multiple strands at once. But this is not my area of research.
It's not mine either.
I'm sorry. Oh, no. It's not mine either, and I question the, you know, as one shifts, I've read some studies that suggest that as one shifts, there's like a period of disconnection, and it's lost time as you decide which way you're going to go. A couple years ago, a relatively unsettling year where I taught at an institution that I will not name, but very deep in the culture of that institution was that it was okay to text message in a class, which I'm ambivalent about. My first reaction was, don't do this, but I didn't force it, and I'm still thinking about it.
A colleague of ours who wasn't able to come today, her research project she's working on is looking at how
young people's cognitive development has shifted over time, and she's speaking with educators who've taught for more than 10 years across 6 different educational domains to see, do they see a difference in the way that the young people that they're teaching are behaving, are thinking, what are their norms in the classroom, in sports, in arts? So, yeah. It's Margaret Weigel.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I'll contact Margaret.
It'll also be interesting, I think, you made me think of how throughout history, different eras are more conducive to certain learning styles or certain personal mm-hmm. preferences, functionalities, etc., to see what's going to percolate to the top as the most functional set of skills for this era. Mm-hmm. I think that will be very interesting to see, and we're not there yet. We don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not just about, you know, moving from one space to the next, but if we're having a conversation, you know, kids want to actually, they're taking you maybe as a credible source, but they're going to be looking up other things to go along with it, to share and add to it, so that they can have more deeper conversations, you know.
As someone who teaches at a school where this is pretty much the norm,
yeah.
you know, I think of it as augmented education,
right?
Not as distraction, but in fact, some of my students are distracted, but yeah. some of my students were distracted 10 years ago.
Right. You know, right.
Most of what I see is students drawing in multiple channels of information, yeah. Yeah. introducing into the class discussion, checking out and following up on things that I've said, correcting yep. me on the fly, formulating me through back channel questions they can't quite get ready to articulate, and then finally articulating them into the class discussion. And all of those levels of information right. processing enhances learning if used effectively.
Well, I've been asking my students what they use their laptop, wireless laptops in class for, and they email me after they've got their grades and the course is over.
What are they doing?
And they say number one is reading their email. Number two is compiling things. These are computer science seniors. And they say, but we wouldn't come to class if we couldn't compile in class because we got to get those projects done. And then the third one is looking up stuff that you say on the internet and stuff. So it's like two things which are, I think, distracting, but the trade-off is they would stay home and do those things if they had to make a choice.
Well, yeah. I mean, Chris Deedy says, he said many times, look, if we can't compete with that, that's our problem as instructors,
right.
not their problem.
It is, that's right.
But I would, you know, to take it back to the topic of the day, which is sort of privacy and security and such, I think the more divided one's attention is, the more likely one is to inadvertently disclose information or inadvertently message the wrong group with the wrong with information you'd rather you hadn't. I'd be concerned about it from that level. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've gotten many messages from students who were in my class who didn't realize they were copying me.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Oh, yes.
But I think the point about, technology not standing still is salient here, too, because you can't just, like, wait for norms to settle down because they won't ever. You have to, at least the norms that develop have to be extremely general. I mean, if you just look at sort of the research that's going on right now in like, brain-computer interfaces, you can see, like, you know, these kids that are posting stuff on Facebook right now will be saying to their kids, sure, I put pictures up there and my preferences, but it's not like I put my brain scan online. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, so I think that, you know, there are some things that are sort of general to the internet, but I think that things are going to be, things aren't going to settle down really, and you have to.
Since there's about 15 minutes left, superimpose one other question into the group just to shift the attention slightly, which is, what are the biggest problems that we think are arising out of this? And maybe things we've already surfaced, participation gap being itself a problem, it could be potentially over-disclosure, as you guys have noticed. If you raise a problem, also what you think the right solution is, or at least a segment of the right solution, noting that none of these things are solved by any one approach.
I like emerging fascism as sort of the role of the state, which we've alluded to a little bit. The government use of all of this for social control purposes, I think, is an enormously high potential that most of us are not really paying enough attention to.
I'd be more scared of the private sector, to be honest, because it's far
bigger. Is there a
difference
these days?
It's far bigger, it's more advanced, it's more lucrative.
I think, speaking to your point, John, about what are the possible solutions, when we're...
You violated the rule right there.
It's immediate, right? They're the ones creating it.
Yeah.
That in some of the curricular things that we're working on is not looking to get at a right answer, mm-hmm. is that these are complicated issues and norms change and technology changes. but you need to foster within young people a culture of reflection of looking at their actions online. And if you want to build a sense of responsibility for young people, it can't be just simple, here's a situation, what's the right thing to do? It has to be difficult problems that they work through, and through that process of working through them, they build reflection and interrogate their decisions. And that's really the way to kind of...
That sounds like just what Henry said earlier.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
What the kids who have more experience with it, more mm-hmm. guidance from home and so forth, are more reflective about yep. each individual decision. Do you think that's enough? I mean, let's imagine that every kid mm-hmm. had the best critical analytical skills you could ever mm-hmm. imagine them having in mm-hmm. terms of mm-hmm. having very conscious sure. sense of identity creation and mm-hmm. you know what information they're receiving. Mm-hmm. Would we be done?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think that we asked them in the interviews, who's helping you? Who taught you how to use this? Who introduced you to this technology? Would you consider them mentors? And that's a gap that a lot of young people not only mention just in general in their lives, they don't have mentors and that no one is kind of shepherding them along in their journey through life, but that they're also left alone online. And, you know, it's a one-to-one. You're on your computer. That there needs to be some sort of supports through organizations, through older siblings, adults, facilitators to kind of help move kids along.
I think one of the things that we need is, to some extent, more public space. So part of it is, I think these are, again, more technological solutions, but a lot more ways of helping people be able to see what information they have themselves online, what sort of traces they leave, what sort of patterns can be made out of that information. I think the extent to which people are more self-aware of what they're doing, it's like, you know, we're not that self-aware of the spinach in our teeth until we have a mirror. But the functional equivalent of really being able to have a lot more mirrors of seeing what's revealable about you online. And I think that notion of transparency follows through to a lot of things, because part of it is, a lot of what's made many online public spaces so appealing is their somewhat deceptive intimacies. You feel you're talking to five people, though you're talking to 500,000. Mm-hmm. And I think as people are more aware of what the audience is for what they're speaking are, so interfaces that give you some idea, even some simple things, like just much more awareness. There's little tools that you can do this with now, but to make it just much more part of people's daily life, that just show you how many people have looked at this profile, how many people have looked at this information, what have they done with it, how are they moving through it, to be able to see the paths of movement and attention. And I think the same is increasingly true of our physical spaces. I am increasingly concerned and interested in the use of cameras outside, and I think there's a huge difference in what we can demand about things like surveillance cameras, because there's a huge range between a hidden camera, which isn't there to dissuade anything, it's just there to gather information, a visible camera, which if you think hard enough, yes, you realize you are being viewed, and a camera with a display that gives you this very visceral sense that this is this alternative space that things in this physical space are being broadcast into. So I think there's a whole principle of being able to look at notions of the transparency of how public things are that we can work towards.
And there's also a big difference between all cameras and the kind of mutual gaze that controlled public spaces in traditional real life situations,
right.
where people watch you, but you watch them, and there's a certain tolerance, so that there may be 100 people in the park, but you only are talking to
right,
five
but that's
friends.
That's a different world. But that is, I'm not saying
but
that
the
we,
expectations.
But that, right, but I'm saying that I think there's ways of taking the world we're moving into and making it less one-sided without just saying we have to absolutely recreate things as they have been.
Rachel and Carrie and maybe Rosalie, one again? No?
A problem that I see is the platforms themselves, and I think we've sort of touched on this, but we haven't stated it explicitly, is the fact that they're owned by for-profit companies that want to sort of, in some sense, encourage imprudent sharing and sort of define the space of what you can do without consideration of some of these issues. And it's also it's also the case, and this came up in the discussion we had at Circus on Wednesday, that it's really difficult. The switching costs between different social networks because of network effects are extremely high. So even if there were good alternatives, you can't just shift yourself. You have to shift your whole social network. So it's thinking about the way that these platforms sort of dictate what's possible and accepted, and the way that they gather this information and use it, I think is worth thinking about, especially with their motivations.
And then they start to dictate how the kids are interacting. They start to interact in these spaces so that it's a little bit dictated by how they're designed, and then that norm spills over into like real world, offline, other network places. So really to think, and I don't know how, because it's hard because you're negotiating this issue of these services are going to be monetized at some point. They have their own goals, and so you're negotiating this with, well, what are like the social effects? And so obviously there's different interests at heart, and at what point are they held liable for creating these spaces that really young kids are interacting in?
And just to be clear, the big ones are being monetized. It's not at some point. Facebook, shouldn't they be monetized? But care you for the longest
time. I think one concern I have about, and we're interested in the ethical issues, and that's clearly the perils and the risks, but how do we think from both the design and a curriculum perspective about scaffolding kids to be more reflective, to be aware of the risks without draining the goods, like what's really exciting and fabulous about what they're doing, how they're engaging, the learning that they're getting from participating in these spaces. And I know it's a huge issue. It's at the crux of the New Media Literacies Project, is highlighting the great skills kids are taking away. So that balance between the risks and the goods.
When we were discussing a little earlier about the third party and kind of dictating what young people do on these sites, from the work that I've been doing on the MySpace memorials, that site was not designed for memorialization. That site was designed to network with friends, share music, whatever. But that young people are taking these technologies and are making them personally meaningful for them, and that it's important to remember that it's not that people are creating norms as a group, and people are, the technologies are changing, but young people are taking the exant technologies and making personal meanings through them as well.
Grant wants to see whether ethical issues in computing could actually be taught, and the results were quite modest and mixed. But one thing that did show up that in the courses that we found did make a difference, it was things that focused on consequences of actions. And so there is some possibility that you can deal with, the students are in novel environments that are novel environments for the faculty as well, but if you get people to think about, for example, your Facebook page when you're going to college or your Facebook page when you're looking for a job, that kind of scenario does seem to help some students in some schools.
I wonder if I might just respond to the this notion about the fear about government, fear about corporations, and also where I was pushing a little, Andrea, on if we succeeded totally on the curriculum and literacies front, where would we be? The reason for behind the question is I completely agree that what you guys are doing and what NML is doing is completely the right and most important step. But I also think there are other things that have to happen. Thinking about this as a lawyer, plainly, but my one is, let's imagine every, you solve the participation gap and you solve, even with the like most advanced kids, everybody's at the best critical thinking stage, right? That we know. Kids don't read privacy policies. I don't read privacy policies. I do it for a living, right? None of us read privacy policies, period. Right?
I read them.
Okay, so 1 in 1,000 people, maybe really an extraordinarily small number of people. And even when people do either read privacy policies or think about terms of use, then they tend to trade the control for convenience, right? You tend to, even when you read the privacy policy, you know that you're giving up control. They have control forever, under any circumstances, can make any change they ever want at any point without notifying you. And they do, right? So even if you're well-informed and have these skills. So I guess where I'm thinking about it from a lawyer's perspective is, what then? What are the backstops that one might need, either technology, designs, other things to do, markets or the law, right? And so one thing that seems at least conceptually attractive is to say, right now the decision making about personally identifiable data is made by whoever holds it, right? It's almost never do you have any interest in that or ability to control it. So is there a way that you could flip it and basically say that you have the decisions, you can make the decisions basically as a user about personally identifiable information about you? There are, the Europeans and others have tried to do this legally. It's a tricky thing to do, but that seems like an important orientation.
A second one is some of these suggestions, which I think are good, for more iconography around privacy controls and so forth, so that, like labeling on a food thing, it's something you actually look at relatively quickly and say, okay, they can change it whenever they want, all right? At least I know, without reading the privacy policy, I'm not one in a thousand, that, you know, they can do anything they want with it, sell it to whomever they want, give it to anybody who they want, you know, and they will. At least I know that relatively quickly. And, you know, on and on, there are a number of different things, obviously, you could do legislatively. I think the other concern about the government access to it, you do have the Fourth Amendment protection in the United States, of course, but one of the things...
Except the Fourth at the border with your laptop.
Well, so there are a series of exceptions to it, which is where I was going to go. So certainly the seizing of laptops, not just the border, but in routine things, the government can get access to lots of stuff they're not meant to and couldn't have done with a warrant, right? So if you have a warrant to go in someone's house, you have to say, I'm going to search this part and so forth. Many more controls than with a laptop. But I think more importantly is the combination of the government and the companies, which is very often the things that the government can get access to are things held by companies, and likewise the kinds of things that companies have and can disclose are therefore not, are also not protected by the Fourth Amendment. So any of these things presents huge risk, I think, if we're thinking about these huge digital dossiers moving forward. So I think that's at least the zone that I was...
For a question for you or anyone else, it's like, how possible would it be to have laws that, for instance, for employers, like right now, if you are interviewing someone, you can see their gender and their race quite clearly, but you just cannot use that in hiring.
Right.
To say that we can't say that you must never look up someone in Google, but you cannot use information that you find in some context or information over the... So it still has to be that sort of mental leap where you may know it, it may affect you, but you know that you're not supposed to be using that.
Right.
Is that a possibility? Or
The ones that you described before are sort of generated out of the Constitution, right? In some sense, that these are basically saying you can't discriminate along certain protected lines, right, or protected classes. I don't know that it's impossible for you to make a rule like this, saying employers, even at a state level, could do it. You wouldn't. It's the sort of generalized right to privacy probably doesn't give you the cover to do this, but you don't need it necessarily, right? All I'm suggesting is you could do it, but it's probably not as kind of driven through existing protections that people have. But I don't see a reason why you couldn't do it if it weren't perfectly drafted. But I think it obviously goes to saying it's a control on the use of the information rather than the collection or the...
Right.
In Oregon, there was a law from, you're probably familiar, from 1995 to 2000 about trying to give individuals rights in their genetic information.
Yep.
It's kind of interesting to see, like, the fact that it wasn't very clearly specified and obviously never came up in court. And there's, you know, I guess because it was so local and there was so much concern about, you know, biotech industry leaving the state and whatever, they ended up moving it to a regulatory stance just because. So I think there are a lot of I think it's a good idea to try and give people, you know, sort of subject some rights in their personal information, but it has to be specified really well, or it's...
Well, it's precisely how it's done right now, right? So we have the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which says in information about you that's your credit information, you can get access to it. You have a right once a year to get it for free from those three credit bureaus, right? And if there's a problem with it, you can correct it. So we do that with health information, with HIPAA.
Genetic.
You have certain rights with your student records, FERPA, for instance. So what we've done is exactly what you suggest.
And there is a new genetic law.
What?
There is a new law that just passed.
Right. I guess the trick was that they were trying to make it a property right. Nobody knew what that meant.
And also the problem with the property right is then you can alienate it, right? So once you make it an asset, that then people, and I think you get back to the, are you going to make good decisions about it once you have
that? I thought
that
the pharmaceutical industry already had large property rights over human proteins and various pieces of the stuff.
Through intellectual property.
Yeah.
Though I think that there's also, you also get into with all these ideas of consent, there's also the problem where you have a bunch of people that, you know, the shared information, when I put up a photo that has lots of people, or in the genetic information, you know, family members and things like that, so it's complex.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And the young people that we've talked to, when we ask them what their general concerns are for the future, some of them have mentioned, I'm worried about privacy, I'm worried about identity theft and things like that, and when we ask them, well, how do you think online harms can be avoided, they do point to, like, well, I think that there should be regulation. Mm-hmm. There should be they have kind of a broader sense that, yes, you're responsible for your material online, but there should be some sort of guiding principle either in law or markets. Or
a backstop, I think.
Yeah,
so.
A backstop.
So since you guys started, would you care for any last words reflecting on how people have reacted to your research? John?
Nothing in particular.
Thank you for your input.
That's wonderful. Well,
thank you very much for sharing it with us at this stage, and we look forward to seeing much more. And thanks everybody for coming over for this chat. We'd love to do it again, as Miriam is going to re-invite you. So thanks everyone very much.